You're listening to the Bats Left Throws Right podcast with your hosts, Jack Almer, Sal LaDuca, and Peter LaDuca. BLTR is the place where right meets left, brain meets body, and where we square up everything else in between. Come on a journey with us with the stories of athletes, coaches, scouts, and trainers who will inspire and motivate you to unleash your fullest potential. Follow us on Twitter at BLTR Podcast and on Facebook and Instagram at Bats Left Throws Right. Tune in through Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Apple Podcasts, and please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review. Welcome to Bats Left Throws Right. I'm your host, Jack Almer, along with the great father-son duo of Sal and Peter LaDuca. Today, joining us is Howard Johnson, the first All-Star that we've had here on the Bats Left Throws Right podcast. Hojo was a two-time All-Star and a two-time Silver Slugger Award winner. He was fifth in NL MVP voting in both of those All-Star campaigns and also took home two World Series trophies during the course of his career. He was drafted in 1978, first by the New York Yankees in the 23rd round of that draft, but chose to go to college instead. And after a year at St. Petersburg College, was picked 12th overall by the Detroit Tigers in 1979 MLB draft. Howard Johnson spent time with the Tigers, Mets, Colorado Rockies, and Chicago Cubs. Of course, you know, he had that really long Mets career where he earned both of his All-Star nods. Peter, as a lifelong Mets fan, what are some of your memories of Howard Johnson and his impact on the franchise?
Well, I don't have any actual memories watching him play because I wasn't born yet. But, you know, I've seen lots of videos. I've seen lots of highlights. I've seen a lot of interviews that he's done. And anytime they celebrate the 1986 Mets on SNY, on the Mets Network, or previous Met games, I'm always tuning into it. And Howard Johnson, he's such a well-spoken guy. He's a great teammate. He's a hustler. He will get his uniform dirty. You know, those are all characteristics that you've seen from Howard Johnson, not just as a player, but as a person too, you know? So he's a gritty guy. And it was really cool talking to him. And the one thing that I was happy to talk to him about was his switch hitting, because we've had a lot of lefty righties or righty lefties on this podcast, but we haven't had a switch hitter. And I believe he was one of the first switch hitters that we've interviewed. And it was really good to dive into more about his switch hitting, what he felt more comfortable with, or which, you know, side he had more success with. And he talked a little bit about the in-game strategy when it comes to switch hitting. So that was really good to get insight and a new perspective on that in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about that switch hitting. Howard, very versatile player, was able to play third base, shortstop, and in the outfield during the course of his career. Sal, what about his approach to the game as a switch hitter and a righty thrower was interesting to you in this interview?
You know, Howard is probably one of those guys who allows hitters to be their own judge of what works best for them. And I think that he brings along his experience and knowledge and an amazing career. He brings that to bear. And actually, I think he mentioned that he encouraged players to steal bases, you know, to be good at base running. Not only that, but he's a real genuine person. I mean, he's really genuine. And I think towards the end of the interview, you know, he mentioned about, you know, his faith. But you know, if you listen to what he talks about in the whole interview, you could see that his faith plays a real big part, a big part in how he really enjoys and how he really wants to help other athletes to really be at their best. He was probably an amazing teammate. He was an amazing athlete. He's a very well-respected coach in the industry. Everybody knows that. I don't think anyone has a bad word to say about Howard Johnson. And, you know, he's named after my favorite ice cream. So
absolutely. Yeah. He's got the ice cream to his name as his namesake. And Sal, you talked a little bit about his base stealing, how he's encouraged his players to steal bases in his later career as a coach. Howard Johnson was great at doing it, though, during his career. We talked about those All-Star seasons. The first one in 89, he hit 36 homers and actually stole 41 bags as well. And then in 91, he led the NL in homers with 38, as well as RBIs with 117, while taking 30 bags as well. Well, one part about Howard's career, though, I find the most interesting was in 2011, at age 50, he returned to professional baseball to play two minor league games with his son, Glenn. So, I mean, at that rate, Sal, I think we really have a shot at getting you back into professional ball.
Yeah, so, you know, there's always hope. But you know something? He's the kind of player that was able to hit for power, hit home runs, steal bases, be relatively consistent. He's like the perfect player, everyday player that you want on a team. And so I think sometimes we get a little bit crazy on, you know, who's the home run hitters and who's, you know, and so...
They don't make them like Howie Johnson anymore. You know, you don't see those kind of players at the major league level today in today's game like Howie Johnson anymore, which is kind of sad to see. You know, you want to see that excitement and that overall package because it is more exciting to watch.
Yeah, so, you know, I think his whole career hits, he had almost, you know, 1,229, you know, career hits. I mean, this is a guy as well as 200 and almost 230 home runs. So this guy's career was not shabby by any means. He's one of those all around athletes. He's like your five tool guy. And then you add on that the fifth tool, which is the character, you know, the personality that comes with that and being a great teammate. They don't make too many of those again these days, do they?
They don't.
No. Not at all. Not at all. Howard Johnson, a real complete baseball player. Excited to get into more of his 14-year MLB career here on the show. So without further ado, we're going to bring on Howard Johnson.
Howard, thank you so much for coming on this
podcast.
We really appreciate you taking some time.
Pleasure.
I'm Peter Loduca.
Oh, hey, Peter. How you doing, buddy?
It's good seeing you. Nice to meet you, sir.
Good to meet you.
Jack, nice to meet you, Howard.
Oh, hey, awesome, Jack. How you doing?
So I want to start off when you were a kid, because the story goes that after Sunday Mass, your mother would take you to the Howard Johnsons for lunch and ice cream. And because you had the same name, you got a free lunch and free ice cream. Is that correct?
That's correct. My mom and dad used to take me after church. I didn't grow up Catholic, so I didn't go to Mass, but went after church. We'd go to Howard Johnson's and eat, and they got to know us a little bit. I told them, hey, my name's Howard. That's my name, Howard Johnson. And so they go, oh, well, we got you covered. And I said, I was just a kid.
So Howard, I'm jealous because I love ice cream. I wish I was born with the name Baskin Robbins.
There you go. That's right. Well, before there was Baskin Robbins, there was Howard Johnson's. They had the ice
cream. That's right. Yeah.
What's the best flavor?
Oh man, I'm pretty simple with flavors. I will get vanilla a lot and add things to it, just, you know, different things to it. But I mean, if I'm going to pick a flavor that I really enjoy from a Baskin Robbins or something like that, or Cold Stone, it's probably going to be like Rocky Road. Probably going to be some mint chocolate chip in there.
Oh, really?
I like birthday cake. You know, I like those things.
So you have a
sweet. I'm not exotic by any means.
You have a sweet tooth, right, Howard?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Okay, great.
During your playing days, was there ice cream in the clubhouse ready for you?
No, we didn't. When I was in New York, we didn't have ice cream in there. Like nowadays, okay, so when I was with Seattle coaching, the home side had its own soft serve machine in there.
Oh my God.
Oh, nice.
So I wore that thing out, man. I absolutely wore it out.
You're on top of that machine. Hey, no one would be able to get to it, right?
Listen, here's what I used to do every day. So I'd get vanilla soft serve, and then I'd put, okay, check it out. Listen. So I'd put, some days I put like corn pops on top of it. Some days it'd be Apple Jacks.
Oh my God. Oh,
wow.
Or Fruit Loops. Oh my goodness. Oh, so good.
Wow. Apple Jacks on soft serve vanilla ice cream sounds actually delicious. That sounds
good. Put it like in a cup. You get a cup, put it in there, man.
Howard, you must have like pissed off when you left that place, right? You're like, I'm taking the soft serve machine.
I'm taking the machine with me.
Based on this conversation alone, I can already tell Howard is one of the most intelligent guys we've ever had on this show, easily. Hands down, to create the
software. I appreciate that. Yes, it's really good, by the way. Just try it. You'll let me know.
Amazing.
So, Howard, let's get into your career. So, a lot of people, they know you, you know, with your time with the Mets, they know you as a coach as well. But a lot of people do forget that when you first came into professional baseball, you were a pitcher. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was a pitcher slash outfielder. That was my, that's how I was drafted. And so, with the Tigers, I didn't do either one with them. Right from the beginning, spring training, they put me at shortstop. And so, you know, they thought I could hit. And so I played short for about, it was at spring training. I played short for another, for when the season started, maybe a month. And then they moved me to third base and they said, that's going to be your spot.
So Howard, if you were drafted as a relief pitcher,
mm-hmm.
if they had continued on that path and said, you're going to be our relief pitcher, would you have like said something? Or, I mean, or was that a position that you had thought?
Good question.
Playing?
It's a good question. I never really thought about it in that regard. I always thought about it like from the opposite. Like I was always a position player, and they, you know, I'm thinking, okay, what if they said, okay, but they never really explored that far because I had success. So I'm not sure like what they were thinking. I pitched in high school as a starter. I was really good. My numbers were really good. I had a good slider, threw hard, and I enjoyed pitching a lot. But I enjoyed being a player better.
Okay, you probably would not have said anything if they just put you in the pitcher's slot and you know put you in the bullpen, yeah. Right?
Yeah, a lot of that stuff they said when they drafted me, they came to talk to me about the signing and all that stuff. They never really brought that up. It was always like, hey, you got a chance to go to spring training and, you know, win a spot on our high A team. And that as an infielder, and that was their plan.
Right.
So if that was going to change, I mean, I guess they could have switched on me, I guess. But at that point, I really wasn't even
at that point, you were like, this is great because you were not upset about, you know, being placed in the field, so to speak, rather than as a pitcher.
No, not at all. No.
And so yeah. Before the Tigers took a shot on you in 1979 with the 12th yep. overall pick, you were drafted by the Yankees 23rd in the 23rd round in 78.
Yes.
What yep. went on during that year that allowed you to jump so high in the draft rankings?
Well, I went to junior college for the semester, and back then you could do that. So I went for the semester and had a good fall. And, you know, you just mature a little bit more. I mean, I was a young senior in high school. I mean, I think I was still 17 years old when I graduated. So I had, you know, another year of physical growth and that, so to speak, strength, put me in a better position, I guess, in January.
And the conversations you had with the Yankees, was there any sort of inclination on your end, like, hey, maybe this is somewhere I'm going to go? Or was it always, as soon as you heard your name called, you're like, okay, that's too low. I'm going to bet on myself for another year.
No, I never really got to that point. I would have signed if they had recommended I signed. If they would have made it a point where, hey, we really want you to sign here, and we think this is what we envision for you, like in the next, you know, year and a half, 2 years, like this is our plan for you if you progress. But they didn't really did that. They kind of, the scout who had to be end up being a friend introduced me to my agent at the time. So everybody was kind of in the family, so to speak, but he wasn't in my family, but a lot of my early roots in professional baseball stemmed from people that the scout Gus Polis knew. And I trusted him. And he said, he goes, look, we'd love to sign you, but if I were you, I would not sign. I would go back to junior college.
Wow.
And for the semester play, right? So if you sign, you go to Oneata. They weren't really pushing it, but they said, look, if you go to junior college and play the semester in the fall, you know, you could really better yourself. And so it just became a choice, you know, do I want to go to rookie league in upstate New York, you know, in 78, or do I want to go to junior college, play, improve my chances? I'd still be ready for spring training the next year if they wanted to sign me then. And I'd be a little bit bigger and stronger. And so it just, the choice came down and it made sense just to go back, go to school for the semester and go make, you know, see what happens.
Howard, are you the first person in your family to, you know, rise the ranks and become a professional mm-hmm. player? Did your dad yeah. was a ball player?
My dad was an athlete. He was in the Navy. And so he brought a lot of the military, the naval, like discipline, those kind of things
oh, wow.
that it takes to, you know, to be good at anything, especially sports. And so I remember watching my dad like lift weights all the time and, you know, played softball. He was a man's man and still is. And it was cool. It was just, so I always grew up in it and we always had the Sporting News and Baseball Digest and all kinds of stuff, you know, at the house. Cause my dad used to get all those publications.
So you got that sense of discipline, work hard, have a structure kind of foundation, correct, Howard?
If you're going to be successful in anything, you got to have that. Right. Unless you win the sperm lottery, then you don't have to. But most guys don't. So, you know, if you're going to be good at something, you have to work at it.
Agree. But yeah. I think God gives us gifts, right?
Yeah.
It's up to us Amen. To utilize those gifts. Now, do you think you were... Obviously, I think you were born with some gifts and it just, you know, the circumstances had it so that you grew up with some structure and some values,
yeah.
valued hard work. And all of a sudden you just, you work your gifts because if you don't, you lose them, right?
Correct. And one thing I learned from my dad very young was the value of practice and being able to spend time working on your game or working on whatever you want to be good at, if you really want to be good at it. I mean, you have a choice to make every day you get up. And so I learned that. I taught that to my own kids. And I teach that to as many young kids as I can when I'm giving lessons or whatever. The value of practice and the importance of sacrifice, so to speak. Many times my dad would say, look, you can go out with your friends on the weekend or you can stay home and, you know, limit those types of things and work on yourself so you become better. And that's the only way you can get better. You know, you're not going to get better by going out partying with your buddies in high school. That's if you want to be a college player or a big league ball player, you're just not going to survive that way.
Yeah. You know, Howard, that's interesting about sacrifice because nothing in this world is free, even gifts. That you're yeah. given not free. And so there's a price to pay, and I don't mean a monetary price. There's a price to pay for success, right?
Yeah.
And it's always about how far are you willing to pay that price? And all of those people, including yourself, who've reached the top of their game, and you say to them, would you do it over again? And you'd say like, listen, I have to sacrifice a lot of things, my family sometimes, in order to get where I am, but would you do it over again? And they'd be like,
oh, yeah. They all say, yeah. You know, a lot of the limitations that we face in life are self-done. You know, we put limitations on ourselves. Like when you're young, you know, that's a time to seek out opportunity.
Right.
And if that opportunity says, hey, you got to go live in this state for a year or two to be able to achieve what you're trying to get to along that ladder, then you can say, I'll do it. Or you can say, no, I don't want to leave home. I don't want to leave my friends. I don't want to leave, you know, so-and-so, whatever. So that's a limitation you put on yourself. And so from that standpoint, you are limiting the outcome of something. If the opportunity is there, you have an opportunity to say yes or no, go get it. Or no, I'm going to wait. I'm not going to do it. Yeah, as you get older, I think it's harder to make drastic decisions like that. But when you're young and you're not tied down by anything, you know, why would you want to limit yourself to get what you really want in life?
Exactly. And sometimes you need to do those things and you need to take the risks when, I mean, calculated risks, obviously not you know, reckless risks, but those kind of risks that you need to take when you're younger, you're not married, you're single. And so, you know, as you get older, sometimes you get married and, you know, you don't have, you don't have those options. It's really funny because I remember some years ago I was watching David Wright, who was doing an interview, and he said, you know, when he was younger, he'd be like, you know, if, I mean, what a work ethic that guy had as well. I mean, you were a mentor to him. And he would say, you know what? I'd be like, if I'm not working out right now, there's someone else out there who's working out and who's going to, you know, he's looking to be better and get better. And so every minute that I don't, you know, try to advance my career or practice, that's someone else who's actually getting one over on me. So the very, you know,
you're never standing still. You're either moving forward or you're falling behind. And my dad used to tell me all the time, there's guys better than you out there. You have a choice to work and try to be good enough. And that's just something I never forget. There's always somebody out there better. And the more you stay in your cocoon and you don't take that risk, then when reality does hit and you see that someone that is better, it just knocks you for a loop and you can't recover.
Absolutely. So you mentioned earlier about how, you know, the Yankees came to you and they said, you know, you probably shouldn't sign, and they didn't really have kind of a plan for how they saw you developing with them. Out of the teams that you did play with, though, who kind of came to you with the best plan and the best presentation of this is why we want you, this is where we want you to be, and who really impressed you in that way?
Well, when I got drafted by the Tigers, and the guy who was in charge of minor leagues at that time was Bill LaJoy. He ended up becoming general manager for them as well, and a scout. He's a tremendous guy. He passed away about probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago maybe. And anyway, Mr. LaJoy, he'd talk to me, and he'd say, look, he said, there's no reason why you can't win a spot in the spring here at our high A club. And I'm like, okay, I said, good. You know, I just want that opportunity to be able to do that. That was my mindset. Like, okay, give me that opportunity. I took him at his word. I mean, he could have been lying to me, but I believed him. And at that point, it just became the option was better there. The opportunity was a little bit better there, and just made more sense for me.
And then, you know, going over to New York, what was kind of that shift in culture like from playing in a city like Detroit to with the Mets in one of the biggest markets in sports markets in the world?
Well, fortunately, when I got to the Mets, Davey Johnson was the manager and the team was on the rise. And so Davey, pretty much from day one, I'd met Davey before down in Clearwater where I grew up at some camps and stuff, baseball camps. So I kind of knew him and we knew each other a little bit. And so when Davey, every chance he had, he knew how to talk to me and he knew like what buttons to push. And he wasn't a guy that was going to get in your face. He was going to try to find a way to use you. And that's the way, you know, Davey laid out a plan. The Mets obviously laid out a plan for me when they traded for me. And just like the Tigers, you know, got a starter in Walt Terrell. So both teams filled a big need. The Mets made it clear that, you know, Ray Knight was aging and they needed a young guy that could step in and fill that role at third because they had a revolving door. And so that was the guy to be up for that. And so I just did use that opportunity and Davey found ways to use me and get the most out of me.
The coaches that you played for, you know, who do you feel like usually put you in the best positions to succeed?
Well, Davey always put me in the best position. He was the guy that found a way to use the last guys on the roster. You know, if you weren't starting, you still had a role. And, you know, he could plug and play you in different ways that was unique. I mean, I played a lot of shortstop with the Mets because that was one way to get, when Ray was playing every day in 86, that was one way to get me in the lineup more, get that extra bat. If Doc was on the mound, he's pretty much a strikeout fly ball pitcher. And so there was less action at short. So he could afford to take the chance on a guy who doesn't play short all the time to get the bat in the lineup. And these are the ways that Davey would think. But when I was younger in A-ball, my second year, so I was 79, I made the Lakeland Tigers. I made the team out of spring, played. And then the next year, I went back to A-ball to repeat, which is a perfectly normal thing to do. And the manager I had was Andy Brinkman, and he taught me the value of playing every day and not taking anything for granted. Right. And not because I was abusing anything, but just as a teaching point to make the value of, hey, you play every day, you don't come out of the lineup, you play every day, I'm going to put you in there, you know, the whole nine yards. I'm like, good. That's what I want to do. So he was a guy that really kind of laid it out there for me.
Howard, you know, when we're looking at your numbers with your time with the Mets, you know, your numbers are very impressive. And the one thing that, you know, you're our first switch hitter on this podcast. So the one thing that I was always interested about was that, you know, for a comfort level as far as hitting, right? You know, obviously, yeah. If a left-handed pitcher is coming up, you want to, you know, hit righty. And if a right-handed pitcher is, you know, you want to hit lefty. But I just wanted to ask, was there any point in time where maybe a right-handed pitcher was, you know, that you were familiar with that maybe you felt could have hit better as a right-handed batter or, you know, instead of hitting lefty? Because sometimes, you know, obviously there's the idea that, you know, when you get to the major leagues, you're a switch hitter, you have to hit on the right side of the plate. But was there ever a time where you felt like, you know what, I'm not going to do lefty-lefty or righty-righty or opposite. I want to hit off righty off of this guy, and he's a right-handed pitcher. Was there times where that came up, or was the illusion that you had to hit lefty off of a right-handed pitcher?
Well, I was a natural lefty, first of all, so that was my default side. And the only time I ever did that was tried it against Glavin with the Braves. Not good. I tried it. I might have tried it one other time, but the reason I tried it was that my reasoning was that Glavin didn't have a big curveball. He was mostly fastball changeup. And so to hit left-handed against him, I kind of took away the changeup. That was his bread and butter. Right. But when I faced him left-handed, he started getting that breaking ball over. It was just out of nowhere. So I really had no chance. I had no success against the guy, basically, because he was getting fastballs in off the play with a cutter, and then changeups were like off the plate. They were getting him strikes. And so it was really tough for me from the right side. So I thought, oh, I'll just switch it over and hit left-handed, try to take away that changeup as a pitch from him. And it didn't work. I think I maybe only tried to hit left on left probably a handful of times in my whole life.
You are a natural left-handed guy, born natural left-handed. So does that mean you would have naturally hit lefty and throw lefty, but the story appears, from what I understand, was that as a natural left-handed hitter, your dad wanted you to throw right so that would give you more options, correct?
Yes. Yes. You play all positions.
Okay. So now here's the thing. So you would have been a natural, you would have been a lefty hitter and a righty thrower. Now, at what point now do you become and decide that we're going to make you a switch hitter?
Oh, my dad did when I was little. When I was 3-4 years old, he'd throw the balls to me in the backyard and, you know, make me hit right-handed. So that's how that all happened. So from a coaching standpoint, like now in present day, or a parent standpoint, if you're going to work with a young kid, try to see if, you know, maybe switch hitting is something that they could do. Typically the test is if you're right eye dominant and you throw right-handed, you should be able to hit left-handed pretty good.
Correct. Because you always want to be, well, here's the thing. You know, there was a study that was done some years ago. I don't know. I think it's been debunked with college players. And the study showed that the better batters were the ones who are cross dominant, so that if they were a right-handed batter, they were left eye dominant. And if they were a left-handed batter, the better batters were
the left of the left handers were the right eye dominant.
Yes. There's a
very small percentage of ones that have no dominance. That's a very, very small. Yeah. And the pitchers, actually the pitchers were the opposite. They said the better pitchers, the better right-handed pitchers are right eye dominant, better left-handed pitchers. So you know what? There's a lot of stuff going on with each kind of what you're born with, how you train your dominant eye. Now, for instance, like the one guy who is, Chipper Jones, he started switch hitting when he was a kid, right? And yep. This guy's career split stats. I mean, I don't know if you could get a mirror. He's a mirror. 304. Yeah. Versus right hand is like 303 versus left hand. I mean, a freaking mirror.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
So, I mean, just mind boggling, right? If there's anybody who's like a mirror, it's Chipper Jones, right? As a switch. So,
which is very difficult.
Yes. I mean, but I think there's a lot of gifts there. And then obviously his hard work and everything. But so you don't have career-wise as much success as a right-handed hitter against lefty pitchers. Now, Do you think that was an eye dominance issue? What do you think is your issue? I mean, in your career, did you try to work that?
No, it's it could have been an eye issue, but actually it's probably more of a at bat issue. So you don't get as many chances. You know, in baseball, you learn, most guys learn from trial and error, and you see something, back in our day, we didn't have all the video we have now. So basically what you saw on TV is what you tried to do. But as a hitter, you just learn by trial and error. I had good success doing this. I saw somebody said that, I'm going to try it and see how it feels. And that's how you learn. And so you need the at-bats to go through that to determine. Yeah. And so when you're natural left, you're not going to get as many at-bats right-handed because you don't see that many left-handed pitchers.
Right.
However, when I knew I was going to be playing every day starting in 87, that off season in 86, I worked my tail off because I knew that as an everyday player, they're going to make you hit on your weaker side when the game is on the line. And I did not want that to be an issue.
And so you worked a little bit harder on.
Oh, way harder.
Okay.
And there was no, because there's no right-hander in my mind that I felt like I couldn't hit.
Right. So if I were instructing kids or at any level, I would say to them, you have a dominant side. You should be taking batting practice on both sides, but sticking your dominant side in the plate, because I think by working your non-dominant side, the idea is to open up it's a neurological issue where you're opening up the pathways on the other side of the brain, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Makes sense.
So now, there seems to be, at one point, after Mickey Mantle, everybody wanted their sons to be a switch hitter. And so I don't know. I think there have been like some articles where they'll interview a lot of the switch hitters, and what they will, I think they predominantly say is, the switch hitting got me to the major leagues. But if I had my way, I would just stick to my dominant side, whatever that is. And so do you think now there seems to be less of an emphasis on the switch hitters, but now even more so because like the Dodgers and the Mets, there seem to be stacking up on these lefty righty guys, whether they're a position player or whether they are a pitcher. Is that the trend? Do you think that's going on now, Howard, or not?
I mean, it's possible. The way I always viewed it was, if you could switch it, that was another tool in your tool belt that you had. And I never thought about not doing it ever, because it's hard enough. And if you have doubt that you can even do it, then, what's the use of doing it? Because if you're put in a situation where you're hitting and you're thinking, I'd rather hit the other side than that doubt is all it takes sometimes. So you can't, that's why I was saying back in that offseason of 86, I worked to the point where right-handed was my natural. That's the way I tried to convince myself that I could be good from that side of the plate when it really counted. Just to work for way more, disproportionately way more from that side of the plate, because I knew that I could not take any BP left-handed, walk up there and probably hit.
Right.
But from the right side, that was always a struggle. So I needed to work way harder to have that be in my own confidence level, something that I knew I could have success on.
So I just got one more question on this, and then we'll move on. Eddie Murray, you know, he was a right-handed hitter up until he was 19. And then he had this big slump, and then, you know, his coach had said, we're going to turn you into a switch hitter, and, you know, the rest is history. Now, Eddie, there was an interview that he had, and he said, you know, when I started practicing and hitting left, I found that he was a dominant right-handed hitter initially. My swing got shorter on my right side. So I'm just curious, did you ever feel the more that you worked one side may have helped to improve the other? Can you just discuss that? What was the issue? You know, where did you feel working one side helped the other? Or, you know, was it equal in that way?
No. And I always tell this to kids, or when I'm teaching them about being a switch hitter, we're working on stuff. I would say to them all the time, this will make you a better left-hand hitter, or this will make you a better right-hand hitter.
Yes.
Just by going through it. So there's a lot of things that go into it when you're talking about a kid and becoming a switch hitter, because most kids nowadays, they don't want to fail at all. And unfortunately, baseball is a failure sport to begin with. And if you're going to learn how to switch it, there's a lot more failure with that than normal, so to speak, than normal. And so if you're going to teach a kid to be a switch hitter, you need the parents to be on board. You need the kid to be on board. Everybody's got to be on board, or else it's futile, unless, you know what I mean? So you got to be honest, got to be realistic, and you got to kind of forewarn, look, you're going to have a lot of success early, and then it's going to struggle for a bit. Or, you know, you're going to make a lot more outs. You're going to be striking out more early on. But if you stay with it and get the at-bats, then you'll start having success, and you'll see how much more better you are.
You talk a little bit there about facing challenges. When you were in that second World Series, you had a little bit of on-field struggles. What did you kind of take away from that experience? And although you guys were ultimately able to win the World Series, not being able to perform up to, I'm sure, what your standards are for yourself on one of the biggest stages.
Yeah, I think it just becomes a confidence issue. Everybody tries to elevate their game in a postseason scenario. You're trying to be better than what you are normally. And I think that's the pitfall. And so it was hard for me to disassociate that from my play. I tried to be better because I knew our competition is good. I mean, you play in a World Series, or you're playing in a, you know, a playoff series or whatever. These games are huge. And so you want to measure up and be better than what you normally are. And so that leads to other issues. And there's an old saying in baseball, the harder you try, the worse it gets. And so you could use that in any position on the field. If you're trying to throw harder as a pitcher, you're not going to be throwing as many strikes. You're going to be missing. And I use this term, this little phrase now with players all the time. If you think of accuracy and speed as two different things on a sliding scale, the faster you do something, the less accurate you become. And the slower you do something, the more accurate you become. And so you try to find that happy balance. And I think in a playoff scenario, our brains are working so fast. We're processing so much information. Just that in itself, it makes you less accurate.
Was that your flow state, Howard? How did you try to like, I got to stay in here? And how did you manage that where you, so I think I found my intersection point.
I believe it was the 1991 season.
That's right.
It was the 30th season.
Yeah.
Well, 87, I learned some things in 89 as well, but for the most part, you're trying to find a practical answer to slowing things down. How do I do that? What do I have to trick my brain basically in order to get me in that state? And so I learned in 1990, actually it was later in 89, Doug Drabek with the Pirates used to get me out all the time on 2031, like cut fastball, where he took a little bit off. It was almost like a change up, so to speak. And because I was so anxious to hit the ball in those counts, I would leave the zone. I would try to do too much and get myself out.
Right.
And that's what big league pitchers do. They let hitters get themselves out until they realize that you're not going to do that anymore.
Right.
And so after about four or five times of this happening to me, I was like, man, I'm not getting myself out again on this guy. So I went up there looking for something slow and just, I was going to sell out on it and say, hey, if I get this ball, I'm not going to get myself out on it. I'm going to hammer it. And sure enough, he did it and I hit a home run. And after that, I realized that I could do that with him. And I started doing it more often because I was a good fastball hitter. So I had quick bat. I could,
right.
I got the barrel from A to B very good. And so what I learned through that trial and error that I could look slow almost every pitch and still hit the fast.
Right.
And that was a huge life-changing revelation that I could do that. Yeah. And so once I started doing that, I used to sit on changeups all the time. And I'd get them. And the reason I was successful is because I'd get the changeup. And most pitchers, they're not as accurate with the changeup. They're not trying to throw it on a corner. They're just trying to throw it over the middle. And so usually those pitches are right down Broadway. You know, they're right there for you to hit. You just have to have the guts to do that and trust that you can still hit the fastball or get out of the way of a fastball if it's coming at you.
So Howard, do you think most of the major league batters, do you think that they're mostly more obsessed with maintaining that hot zone, that particular pitch that they're waiting for, that they know they could just cream it out of the park? And are they sometimes a little bit afraid to work on some other stuff because they may think that if I work too much on this other stuff, I'm going to lose what I got in the other part? And so do you, and I would tend to think, not being an athlete, do you think that the more that you work on your weaknesses, the better your strengths become? Do you think that's something that applied in your career?
Yeah, 100%. You learn that, like, and if you're going to be an everyday player, you have to work on your weaknesses because you get known in baseball for what you can't do.
Right. They figure you out right away.
Yeah, I mean, even in scouting, like scouts, they'll come watch a player play and they'll see a kid hit. He maybe have like plus power, but they'll say, yeah, but he can't run, or he can run, but he can't hit, or he can't throw. So that's what you get known for. And I learned this at a young age too. If you don't work on those weaknesses and they really define you, and you're already limited when it's time for your time to be up the bat or be in the lineup or whatever, you're limiting yourself. If you know that you're weak at something, the other team knows you're weak at it as well. And so you got to be able to trick your brain by hard work and success together that this is what I have to do in order to be my best self on the field.
So everything that you learned, you know, throughout that 1991 season, what were you able to tell David Wright when 2007, when he had that season? Was there anything that you were able to teach him or tell about your experiences that he was able to accumulate and put together? Or was there not too much? Because even though he, you know, obviously he had the 30-30 season, you know, the game in 20 years has evolved. So what were you able to tell him that allowed him to eventually be able to join that club with you?
Right. Well, David was all the players that I had in the minor leagues but especially for David, that was something that we worked on all the time at every level, stealing bases and making that a weapon. Because I learned a long time ago when I was a kid, reading in Baseball Digest, it might have been Lou Brock or something like that. He said, "Hey," he goes, I'll take the walk and try to steal second and score a run." Right. And so he wanted to be a pest, so to speak, like, you know, when he got on base. And so I always remembered that, so that if I could somehow make myself valuable in that way. So if I got walked, then I was going to make him pay. I'm going to steal second. I'm going to get in a scoring position. I'm going to score a run for my teammate and our team on a base hit. So I could be 0-for-3 and still get to walk my fourth at bat, steal a base, score a run. And I feel like I did something to help the team, but it may be more valuable. So the more things you can do, the more options you have. When one part of your game isn't working, you have another part of your game that can elevate that. And so you're always bringing value to the table. And so that's just the way I approach the game from a young standpoint. And my dad, you know, has really spent time, you know, trying to make sure that was a mindset that he developed in me. And so with David Wright, it was the same thing. I'm like, "David, you can steal bases. We're going to work on our jumps. We're going to work on this and that." And when I got the job coaching first in 2007, that offseason, I told David on the phone when he called me, I said, "We're going 30-30 this year." I said, "This is our goal. We don't have to tell anybody, but this is our goal." Okay. So every time we're out there, we're looking to run. We're looking to push the envelope. We're looking to create opportunities for our teammates. We're looking to create havoc with the other team. So if they walk you, you're going to make them pay. And so that was our mindset, and it worked beautifully. And that those conversations happened all every year, like trying to get better and better. How can we develop this part of your game to make you better?
One thing about David Wright, over when I was watching him, there was a point where I thought that David Wright was getting to be too predictable, right? I saw that they were, you know, he wouldn't hit the first pitch, for instance. And even if it was right smack where it needed to be. And then they would try to get him, you know, a little bit further off the plate so that he'd, like, you know, lunge for it all the time. Mm-hmm. It just seems as though, so one thing about, and not just David, many major league players as well as yourself, how do you know when you're becoming too predictable and you've got to change it up somehow, right?
Coaches. So you have to have coaches that are watching the game and they're paying attention and they are thinking along with you. And that was one of the keys for me as a coach, was that I put myself in the box with those guys. Right. So it wasn't just David getting his at-bats. It was the guys hit in front of him, behind him. You know, every guy in there. So you're learning to think how they think. And once you know those guys, that's why relationship is important as a coach, because the more you know about players, how they think about things. And if you pay attention, I mean, the game is right in front of you. So there's no reason not to know it.
You know, it's funny when Sal earlier posed the question about when it all kind of came together for you as a player, Peter brought up the 91 season, which, great year for you. You led the National League in home runs and RBIs, but you brought up the 87 season, which on your Wikipedia page is actually labeled as your breakout year. What about that season really kind of helped you figure it out as an MLB player?
Well, I hadn't figured out the whole changeup thing yet in 87. That didn't come till 89, but 87 is when basically I worked so hard that you're right-handed on stealing base and also on my jump stealing, that I became really an unstoppable force at times. I mean, right-handed, my numbers were ridiculous. So good, right-handed, best year I've ever had in my whole life. And till injuries in 80, 88, 89, I bounced back. And then, you know, I learned the changeup trick. And then, you know, after that, I was all, the off year was 90. I got hurt again. And then 91, you know, I was healthy and I put it kind of put it all together. That was my last good season. And then injuries started taking their toll on me. And that's the only downfall to being a runner and a hitter, especially a power hitter, is, you know, you're running, you're putting tremendous stress on your body, stealing bases, diving head first, doing all these things, you know, to give yourself value and those, in that way, you're doing damage to your body while you're doing it. And it just took its toll on me. But, yeah, you have to work on your weaknesses because you're going to be challenged there when the game is on the line. And I did not want to be up there hitting right-handed thinking I'm not a very good right-handed hitter. I wanted to be the guy who's like, hey, bring in that lefty. Let's go. I'm ready. You know, I got this.
So do you think, looking back and now working as a coach, is there anything that players who played like you do can do today in order to try to prevent those injuries? Or is that just something that comes with, you know, kind of the gritty style of playing?
Yeah, it just kind of comes with the gritty style of playing. Most guys nowadays, they don't put themselves in that position because they don't want to get hurt. The money is so great now that if you get hurt and miss a year, it's going to really hurt you financially down the road. So unfortunately, I understand it. I guess I don't really blame them, but to me, I wasn't really brought up that way. I was brought up, you don't take anything for granted. You don't know that tomorrow's a given. You play hard today, give it your best shot, work to try to keep your body in shape, and take care of the pounding that it's going to take. I wasn't a big person, but you know, you just work on that stuff and just boom, you know, you can't think about, well, I'm not going to play as hard today or do this today. Yeah. Cause I don't want to hurt myself, might hurt myself down the road. You just can't think that way and be successful.
Howard, do you think that being a switch hitter and working on both sides of the plate, practicing on both sides of the plate, do you think that might have been, is a way to prevent injury or sort of like prehab? Because neither side, you know, sometimes when you're constantly working one side of the body over time, you know, skeletal muscular system gets warped, and then you have to go back. Then you go back to the chiropractors and your trainers who try to readjust you. But the problem is that when you get back to the sport specific training, you know, all of the gains that you make sometimes in the gym with your trainers and your chiropractors and whatever gets negated again. So as a switch hitter, do you think that may have helped you stay, prevent some injury and stay healthy to a certain extent?
Yeah, I'm sure it did, Sal. I mean, that's proven. If you just work one side all the time, your body's going to break in that side first.
Right.
So you've got to train both sides. You've got to stay ahead of the game in that regard. You have to work both sides to keep your body balanced, and that should keep you from injury down the road.
You played with Gary Carter during your time with the Mets. What about his leadership did you sort of take away from playing with him and having him as a teammate?
Kid was awesome as a teammate. Very positive. He's a Christian, strong Christian. So we used to talk all the time. He was very sensitive about the media, but in a good way. I mean, everybody's sensitive about the media. Very few guys say, I don't care what the media says, because, you know, media is out there, especially in New York City. You got all the newspapers and everything. You just can't get away from it. But the kid just wanted to be respected. He knew the team when he was in Montreal, he was a legend. And then he came to the Mets and, you know, Keith was already there and, you know, Straw was a young kid coming up. So there was a lot of veteran leadership already. And so kid just needed to fit in, but he wanted to be the leader. And I totally understand it. I don't blame him. I would want that too. And I know that was a thing that probably bothered him the most, but Gary was a great example of, I'll tell you my best Gary Carter story. So in 86 World Series, in the ninth inning, you guys may have heard me say this before, but ninth inning, so we're down by two runs to Boston in game six. And he was up third that inning. And guys are on the bench, kind of just bewildered, like, what's going on? Can't lose this game. And kid just going up and down, telling everybody, like, pulling you by the shirt, you know, pulling you close. So I'm not going to be the last out of this World Series. And just like he was talking himself into it and talking us into it at the same time. So when he battled like he did in that at bat where he fouled off all the two strike pitches, he got a base hit. It's like, he's like, man, this, you know, you start thinking, okay, we can maybe will our way through this thing. And it just, you know, just snowballed on the Red Sox. I mean, it was just one of those things, but that was my best Carter story. He was just, he's just an awesome guy.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining us here today and talking baseball. It was just an absolute blast to have you on. We're going to wrap up with Peter doing some rapid fire questions, some quick hitters for you. But, you know, thank you again for
my pleasure.
Come join us.
I'm glad to do it, guys. Thank you so much.
Who was your idol growing up?
Reggie Jackson.
Oh, wow. Very nice. What is your favorite baseball movie?
The Natural.
That's very good. What was your favorite walk-up song that you used in your MLB career?
We didn't have walk-up songs back in our day.
No way. Are you serious?
No, we didn't have nothing like that.
They sang the song themselves.
The players are responsible for that. Now when you go up there now, you got like three or four. For every at bat, you got one.
My goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
But let's just say you were playing
today. We had an organist back in our day.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, that's it.
So what was your favorite venue or your favorite city that you played in?
Chicago. Wrigley Field. Yes.
All right, so we got a couple questions regarding food over here. Are you a Chipotle or a Moe's kind of person?
Not Chipotle.
Not okay. Chipotle. Definitely not Chipotle.
Okay.
I used to call it Chipotle all the time. So someone they tell me, oh, it's Chipotle. I'm like, oh, okay.
Are you an In-N-Out or Shake Shack person?
In-N-Out.
Okay.
All day. Four by four, animal style.
Wow.
The animal style fries are good with the cheese and the onion and the bacon. I mean, that's real good.
The burger animal style, 4x4 animal style. I'll take it all day, every day.
Oh, man.
And last question. So last question we have here. So in an alternate world, you're not a baseball player. You're just Howard Johnson, right? You execute a successful heist and obtain $10 million from the bank. Where's the first place you go?
Oh, my gosh. $10 million? Jeez.
Yeah, Howard, you're going to be able to keep the money. There are going to be no repercussions. That's
nothing.
It.
Where's the first place you go?
Yeah.
I'm probably buying a boat. How about that?
Yeah.
I'm buying a boat. That's what I'm going to buy. I'm going to make Tiger's boat look like a dinghy. I might buy two, but $10 million will get you a big boat. I might get two boats.
So
yeah, get a fleet.
I'm just going to live on one.
Right?
Yeah. I'll live on one.
One more question. In your professional baseball career, what was the one singular baseball moment that you like, that's like above all of the rest?
From a personal standpoint?
Yeah.
Well, the Mets World Series was special. Can't think of another moment that stood out like, okay, that defines people, you know. That's and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I love being a part of the 86 Mets. You know, I love being a part of that group. I mean, you guys wouldn't be talking to me if I wasn't. Think about it. I mean, you go to New York, people remember the Mets. They remember the 86 Mets. You know, I can still get a free steak dinner there every now and then. So I like that part of it.
New York. Dude, when you come to New York, you know, you're going to contact us. We're going to take you out for some good steak dinner and some Italian, the best Italian
please.
Out there. Yeah.
You can't be named Salvatore.
Like
without being Italian.
We're going to meet in the office. What are we going to do in the office? We got to, you know, it's about the dinner table. Like we got to be around the dinner table.
He's going to make you an offer you can't refuse.
That's right.
Good. Yeah.
Howard, one more because What do you think was the most defining moment in your life that may have changed the trajectory of your life and career? Is there one?
Probably accepting Christ.
Okay.
As my Lord and Savior. And now, and I didn't really start living it until later on, but I had the I had that conversion in 1990 and understood what it was about. And then, you know, my life changed after that.
That's beautiful, Howard. Howard, thank you so much for being a guest on this show. And you've been so gracious. You know, we're a bunch of scrappy guys from the New York and the Boston area. And we really appreciate your time. And we hope you enjoyed this.
Yeah, event. Man, I did. You guys are great. I appreciate it. It's very, very good interview. And you guys are good, man. You'll be successful. If this is what you want to do, more, if you want to do more of it.
We're trying, Howard. We're trying.
Absolutely. Good. We'll need you back on the show at some point. It was an absolute blast to have you.
Sure. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Thank you, sir. All the best. Stay safe.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Bats Left, Throws Right podcast. I've been your host, Jack Almer, along with Sal LaDuca and Peter LaDuca. We had a great time with you here today. Just as a reminder to please follow us on Twitter at BLTR Podcast and on Facebook and Instagram at Bats Left, Throws Right. Tune in through Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Apple Podcasts. And please be sure after this interview to rate, subscribe, and review. Thank you again for tuning in.